It is 10 o'clock here, actually 2 minutes past 10 in the Inland Northwest. You are tuned to the stations of Spokane Public Radio, and it's time for a From the Studio presentation. Spokane String Quartet and their special guest, the horn player from the Spokane Symphony, Clinton Webb, are in our studio, and they're going to play some Mozart for us to get things underway. Music of Wolfgang Mozart to open up this issue of From the Studio here at Spokane Public Radio. That was the first movement from the Quintet for Horn and Strings in E-flat. Again, for you scorekeepers, that is Kirchhoff 407. And it was played for us by members of the Spokane String Quartet. And just to remind, their membership is the violinist Mateusz Wolski and Amanda Howard Phillips, violist Jeanette Wee Yang, and cellist Helen Byrne. Augmented on this occasion by the quartet's guest artist for the weekend, the principal horn of the Spokane Symphony Orchestra, Clinton Webb. And I've got Helen, Clinton, and Amanda in the studio with me now. First of all, thank you so much for playing that. That's lovely, lovely stuff.
Oh, what a delight.
It's fun.
Yeah. And it's part of a program that represents the work of three composers, one of whom is very much living, Caroline Shaw. We played one of her vocal pieces in the last hour. And also on the other end of the spectrum, the music of Johannes Brahms. But Clinton, since you're straight across from me, we'll start with the Mozart piece.
Great.
And I guess it should be mentioned out of the box that the horn you play is not the one that Mozart wrote for.
No, absolutely not. Mozart had never seen such an instrument in his entire life.
At what point did keys come into the...
Well, vowels were invented as sort of a part of the Industrial Revolution in the early 19th century, so well after Mozart had died. And the earliest horns actually only used vowels to sort of augment the existing technique. You frequently get asked when you play the horn, what's your hand doing in there? And in point of fact, that's sort of a vestigial organ of the way we used to play horn, which is we used our hand to affect the color and pitch of the notes we were playing. And then that became the technique which sort of stuck around once vowels were invented. And then over time, valves sort of supplanted hand technique, and now the hand does some special effects and some intonation things and affects the color of the horn, but it's not like playing the natural horn where you would use your hand to play every note. And if people come to the performance on Sunday, I'll bring my natural horn and show them a little demo, and so they can see what exactly is my hand doing in there.
Is it a little bit like some of the other instruments of the period in terms of if the piece changes key, you need to swap out instruments?
Yeah, exactly. So a natural horn is a fixed length. So for the Mozart, it's an E-flat, so it's roughly 14 feet of tubing. And then basically that length of tubing gives you the natural overtones of that length. It's like you have a single string, and you can touch the harmonics on the string, but only those notes are available. And then you use your hand to sort of color those notes. This particular piece is really interesting because it has a ton of writing in it that's actually surprisingly difficult to play with hand technique. It's really quite advanced, especially for the time period. And it's apropos also that Brahms is on the program, because Brahms was also, even though living in a time period when valves had become the accepted practice, was a deep aficionado of the quality of the natural horn and wrote all of his music with the intention of it being played on the natural horn, although in his lifetime he almost never heard it performed that way. His Brahms trio for horn, violin, and piano was actually never performed in his lifetime for him on natural horn, and he wrote several letters complaining about this to people in his circle.
Well, I have a question about natural horn versus strings. Is it a louder instrument? Is it a softer instrument than modern horn?
That's an interesting question. So it depends on the context. In the Mozart, for example, because I would be using my hand to affect the quality of sound, it would have sort of a softer, more vocal quality. Okay. And this is what Brahms and especially the early 20th century French composers really found they were missing when we moved to the valve horn. And I'm trying my best to imitate some of that quality on my modern instrument. By contrast, if we were talking about a Baroque composer like Bach or Handel's famous, you know, water music for the Royal Fireworks, that music was written for also the horn, but horn players call it the Baroque horn to indicate that it is not played with the hand in the bell, but rather with the bell up in the air. And it's quite brazen and brash, like a trumpet. But because the instrument is so long, it gets this really sort of... sort of exciting kind of crass quality that composers in that time period expected. And then as hand technique developed, composers expected a different quality out of the instrument.
There's there are certain groups, recording groups, who use that style of horn for playing music of the early 19th century, and it is a very different sound. It does have that special snarl to it that you don't find.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've played with a few different brass players and brass instruments over the years. We did trumpet a few years ago. We did tuba with Leonard, and now we're doing a horn piece, and it's really interesting how difficult it is to put string sound inside of the rounder, bigger sound of a wind instrument. And the clarinet might be the easiest one to work with, or bassoon, because it has an oboe, it has a narrower focus, so it's more like a string sound. But it's like the target is 4 inches wide, and you have to just put your note right in the middle of it somehow, and it's really hard to do. So,
in taking a look at the Mozart piece, the quintet writ large, is Will Clinton, to what degree is it a solo piece for horn, and to which degree is it an ensemble piece? I know that the lines are blurry, for sure.
Of course. But. Yeah, that's a really interesting question. The piece was written, presumably, we don't actually, this is one of those Mozart pieces that was sort of copied multiple times and multiple people, so we don't have the entirety of the original manuscript. But it was presumably written for Ignaz Leutgeb, who was the person that Mozart wrote his concerti for. He actually started 7 concertos for this guy. He was really a big fan of Leutgeb's playing. So this was presumably written for him as well. And Mozart definitely envisioned him as like a horn soloist. So from that context, one would assume it has sort of a soloistic quality to it. However, from actually playing the work, I feel quite strongly that there's so much opportunity to really meet my other musicians. We trade lines, and I play something, and then Mateusz plays something, or I'll hear Mandy play something interesting, and I'll try to imitate that. So it's really, as a horn player, there aren't that many pieces written for us that give us a chance to do this, and it's really a joy to get to play this type of chamber music where you really get to interact with musicians directly one-on-one, as opposed to sort of sitting in the back and waiting for your big solo, and the conductor gives you the finger, and then you sort of go. And as James has said to me often, he's used to horn players not even looking at them. He gives them the go now, and then they sort of eyes down, and
they knew all the time when to come in. It's mentioned, Amanda, it's mentioned in the program notes that there's something that is different, that is special about your part, the second violin being written down toward the viola register.
Right. So this piece is actually written for horn, violin, 2 violas, and cello. So I am making my debut as a violist this weekend. I'm playing second viola, and it's challenging. It's a lot of fun. I love playing viola, but playing in a chamber music setting, it's interesting how just finding my place in the balance is different than playing second violin. And it's just a color and a balance that I'm not used to. And so it's been fun and challenging to try and fit into that ensemble sound.
Obviously, for the most part, in chamber music, you find yourself leaning toward the first violin because you're usually in dialogue or running alongside that part. Whom do you lean toward in this piece, or does it change as the piece goes forward?
Well, yeah, I think it actually changes a lot. Obviously, I have a lot with the first violist, Jeanette. I also have a lot with the horn, and it's just a really neat color to bounce off of. And then, of course, sitting next to Helen and getting to bounce off of the cello part as well. It's a lot of fun. It's really satisfying to play.
Neat. Great piece. Really look forward to hearing the entirety of it on the weekend. We go now to actually the piece that opens, or 3 short pieces that open the
okay,
you're
so,
changing the order
so,
of the program
yeah, so,
on me.
So alert. we're switching the order of the halves. We just decided it would be way more fun to end with the horn the horn last movement is just such a hoot, and it was a great closer.
Like, where do you go from there?
So we're starting with the Brahms, which actually has a lovely sunny opening to it. So it'll be a great first half piece.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's spend a couple of seconds with that, because I had my own program change in the wind. I've got something set up by Carolyn Shaw to play out, play us out. But the string quartet number 3 by Brahms is the last one that he wrote.
Well, that he kept.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There was that grand bonfire stuff that we will never hear. How is it approaching this piece? Is it formidable? Is it?
Well, it is big, and it's big for the viola. We've been teasing Jeanette that it's really a viola concerto, especially the. I grew up listening to the Cleveland Quartet recording of that, and the viola just rips into this piece, and it's that's the sound I have in my ear. But it's actually which movement is it where the violist is the only one not muted? So the other three of us, it is an accompaniment role, but we're kind of wondering if Brahms was thinking of balancing the colors, because the viola has a little bit of a muted color anyway, so that the rest of us sound more in the viola realm, instead of making her try to compete with the rest of us in that our what snarlier sounds. So
right, very good. The sound of Brahms in my head is something that has incredible warmth and richness. Through the different pieces and the totally different time periods that you're playing this weekend, is there a Brahms set of ears that you have to attach, as opposed to a Carolyn Shaw set of ears to attach, in terms of tone color?
Well, Carolyn Shaw is very specific about her tone colors. She's got really delightful instructions in her in her music. What was the one
Midwest lilt?
A Midwestern lilt.
Yeah.
And she often she often is very specific and very cheeky with her instructions to the performers. So in that sense, I think we have to really be quite flexible and because the piece is it's all about language and how we communicate. And I think there's a lot that's very conversational in it.
And the Brahms, because this one is in B flat, it is a warmer, key for us to play in than the other two quartets of Brahms. So it does, and I feel like a lot of it is lower in pitch on the on all of the instruments. We don't spend so much time, except for Mateusz, of course, who has to go flying up to the top of the fingerboard. But it's a warmer sound just inherently in the writing, and so it's easy to kind of sink into that. And we don't have to think about it too much. I think it's a sound we like to make.
Very good. Well, let's go to the works of Carolyn Shaw that you're playing. She wrote 3 essays for string quartet. And of course, when you say 3 essays, most people who have knowledge of 20th century American music will think of Samuel Barber and his 3 essays for orchestra. Any connection aside from, or is this just a happenstance? It looks like there's not.
I'm not sure off the top of my head, but I think it's kind of a statement, musing upon something. And like I mentioned before, she's kind of musing upon the nature of language and communication.
Mm-hmm. All right. An essay, of course, is, we all wrote them when we were in school, and it's... At its root, it's an attempt to grapple with an idea, understand an idea. Is that a process that you can kind of hear going on in Carolyn Shaw's work?
Sure. I think that she said about her about these three works that that it's about communication, it's about language, whether it's about how people communicate and miscommunicate, or computer language. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of, an exploration of the language of speech and communication and how we connect with one another.
All right. Yeah, it sounds like a wonderful piece. I know you've played the music of Carolyn Shaw before. I know that you've played the piece that I got queued up here, On Tract.
Yes.
Is there another piece of hers that you've played along the way?
We played Blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, right. Right, which is another really, really fine piece of hers. And a very, very much a varied composer in what she writes, and very much a vocal composer.
Yeah.
Because, of course, she's famously part of an ensemble, which I assume she's still part of it. The vocal,
Room Full of Teeth.
That's the one, yes. And she's written quite a bit for that ensemble, and also... delightfully for solo voice. Do you detect that in these pieces? Is there a vocal quality to her writing that's identifiable in it?
I don't see that in this piece. Actually, maybe the most vocal lines are in the cello, which is kind of fun because a lot of times, especially in the first movement, which is all about confusion of languages, she'll have each of the instruments playing. We're in the same meter, but they have to play different note lengths against each other. Like one person will have sixes, one will have fives, one will have fours. And then the cello just gets to play this gorgeous melody, which is not hard at all. And I'm like, ha, 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 I get the good part.
Well, and just the very opening of the first essay, I think, it sounds really breathy, like whispering, speaking, rather than singing.
Well, and what about the second movement? She wants a technique she's calling overpressure. We're not even quite sure how to best accomplish that. We've listened to some recordings and watched some videos.
Yeah.
Because it goes from a sound which would sound like that, like you're
almost like you're clearing your throat.
Yeah, and then it evolves into pitch, and it's kind of hard to have that happen all together. Because your instrument will speak at slightly different time than, and so
it does
that,
what it wants to do. But you're trying to guide it.
And so it's really interesting that she's asking us to do that. And I don't know if that's where that's coming from, the computer language movement, where it starts, and wondering whether that the noise factor of it is relating to that. I don't know.
Music for our time, for sure. Yeah. It's a part of the program that's going to be happening this coming Sunday at 3:00 at the Bing Crosby Theater. Spokane String Quartet, along with their guest Clinton Webb, will be playing quite a varied program that will start with the music of Johannes Brahms. So everybody kind of settles into that, and then do an intermission, and then following that will be the three essays of Carolyn Shaw. By name, Nimrod, Echo, and Ruby. And then concluding with a quintet for horn and strings, the music of Wolfgang Mozart. Thank you all for coming in this morning and for playing for us and for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks so much for listening.